Chapter 2. Young Minds and Old Men. Orforth tried to keep his frustration in check, but it was hard in the face of such thick-headedness. Teon wouldn't listen. He had no interest in listening, and stared defiantly at Orforth, daring him to press on. Orforth perched on the edge of his desk, a finely made piece of furniture crafted by Holtwine himself, and folded his arms across his chest. "I ask you again, Teon," he said, pointing to the tally marks chalked on the slate. "If you multiply the first number by the second, what do you end up with?" Teon looked over at Gorseth, his best friend and companion in troublemaking. He winked and said, "A sore head? It's all nonsense anyway. Who needs numbers when he can swing a sword as well as I can?" He flexed his arm and Gorseth laughed on cue. The rest of the class nervously followed. "Enough," said Offorth, lifting the birch cane from beside his desk. "Go ahead," said Teon. "I dare you. My father will kill you, old man or not." For all his bluster, Teon was popular with the other boys. Powerfully built for his age and blessed with handsome features and an easy manner beyond the classroom. Close to his 15th birthday, he would soon ride out on his first war hunt. His father was Orvin, one of Alfgeir's captains of battle, and the boy saw little need to spend his days cooped up in a classroom when there were fights to be gotten into and maidens to pursue. Orforth stood and limped towards Teon's desk, the cane swishing the air before him like a threshing scythe. "Every day you cheek me, Master Teon," said Orforth. "Every day you test my patience. But I counselled King Beorn in the time of woes when all around us threatened to destroy the Unbarogan. I stood at his side when the Cherusans and Talutins raided our lands. I brokered the peace that first united those tribes as allies, and I have spoken with the kings and queens of all the great tribes. I have done all this, and you think you can intimidate me. You are a foolish young boy with a head as thick as a greenskin skull and the manners of a forest beast." Teon frowned, unused to being spoken to like this. He was off balance, and Orforth smiled as he stopped by the boy's desk. Orforth tapped the cane on the arithmetical problem chalked on the slate surface of the desk. "Now, I am asking you again, what is the answer to the problem?" Teon looked up at him defiantly before spitting on the slate and smearing the chalk illegible with his sleeve. "A pox on you, old man! I spit on your sums and letters!" "Wrong answer," said Orforth, slashing his birch cane down on Teon's fingers. The youngster snatched his hand back with a howl of pain. Tears brimmed on the curve of his eyes, and Orforth wasn't proud that he hoped they would spill out. Some shame and humility would do the boy a world of good. Teon's face flushed with anger, and he rose to his full height, clutching his hand to his chest. "My father will hear of this," he spat, heading for the classroom door. "Indeed he shall," said Orforth, "for I will tell him, and he will give you a sound beating for disrespecting your elders. Your father knows the value of discipline, and he would thrash you within an inch of your life were he to see you behave like this." Orforth wished that were true. Orvin was as brash and quick to anger as his son, yet he was a fierce warrior and had ridden with Alfgeir's knights for 10 years. Though Orforth did not like the man, he knew of his respect for the proper order of things. He just hoped his son saw that. Teon paused, and Orforth saw the battle raging within him. To lose face by complying with Orforth's demand, or to risk a beating from his father. The lad returned to his seat, though he continued to glare fiercely at Orforth. "Thank you," said Orforth, moving between the lines of desks. A dozen boys and girls filled his classroom, a dusty room within a timber-built schoolhouse on the southern bank of the River Reich. 100 children of Reichdorf learned their numbers and letters here, taught by women he himself had instructed. No men taught at the school, for the youngsters tended to rebel more against male teachers and seemed more reluctant to pick fights with the matronly women Orforth had chosen. "I know what you're thinking," he said. "You are thinking that this is a waste of time, that you would much rather be practicing on the field of swords, learning how to fight. The skills of a warrior are important, and every Unbarrogan needs to know them. But consider this. Without your numbers, how will you know how much beef to carry in your wagons when you go to war? How much grain and fodder for the horses, and how much extra for the beasts of burden who pull those wagons? How many swords will you need? How many arrows and what size of war chest should you bring to pay your soldiers? Allforth paced the length of his classroom, his limp forgotten as he warmed to his theme. And what of your orders? How will you read the map to deploy your warriors, or read the names of the towns your captain has sent you to? Will you be able to work out how far you must travel, or where your evening campsites must be? How will you send word to your fellow warriors without knowledge of your letters? He paused by Tion's desk and fished a lump of chalk from the pockets of his grey scholar's robes. He scratched the problem on the slate once more. Now, let's try again, he said. The lesson continued for another 20 frustrating minutes, with the youngsters seemingly incapable of grasping the concept of numbers and solutions that couldn't be calculated on their fingers. Allforth pinched the bridge of his nose between his fingertips and took a deep breath. Everything was easy when you knew how it was done, and it was hard to remember what it was like not to know these things. He was in the process of chalking a simpler problem on the board when an excited shout went up from one of the boys seated by the window. Offorth heard the sound of metal and the whinny of horses from beyond the walls of the schoolhouse. "Look!" shouted a girl with corn-coloured hair and petite features, pointing at something beyond the window. She bounced on a stool with excitement, clapping her hands together. "Erline!" snapped Offorth. "Your attention, please!" "Sorry," said Erline, "but look!" The rest of the class hurried over to the windows, and an excited babble broke out as the boys cheered and the girls blushed and scolded one another at their whispered suggestions. Offorth stooped to look through the window and knew there would be no more lessons today. While part of him was angered at that fact, he could not deny his Unbarrogan heart was stirred by so formidable a display of martial power. 50 horsemen rode down the thoroughfare, each armoured in a heavy shirt of mail and gleaming iron breastplate. They bore crimson and white shields bearing the hammer of Sigmar, and each carried a lance supported in a Teluton-style stirrup cup. Spitted upon each lance-tip was a rotting greenskin head, a glorious banner of white silk emblazoned with a black cross and wreathed skull flew over these warriors, and Offorth smiled as he recognised the bronze-armoured warrior who rode at the head of these horsemen. Alfgeir, Grand Knight of the Empire. Sunlight filtered through the forest canopy in thin bars, leaving much of the silent spaces beneath cloaked in shadows. Cuthwin slid through the trees towards the road, a seldom-used track that ran south from Reichdorf all the way to the Grey Mountains. Hardly anyone used these roads anymore. The settlements at the foot of the mountains had been destroyed by greenskins 10 years ago, and the wilderness had risen up to claim them back. But someone was using them now, someone who was in trouble. He moved with an arrow nocked to his bow, a magnificent weapon of yew and ash inlaid with lacquered strips of rowan. Blessed by a priest of Tal, the weapon had never once let him down, and had saved his life more times than he could count. The string was loose, but could be drawn in an instant. Sounds of battle were coming from the road, the clash of iron weapons and the screams of wounded souls. Normally, Cuthwin would give such sounds a wide berth, for the monstrous denizens of the deep forests were as fond of making war amongst themselves as they were on humanity. He'd been about to carry onwards to Reichdorf when a loud bang echoed through the forest. Birds fled the treetops, and he darted into hiding to string his bow. Another booming echo rolled through the forest. Cuthwin knew that sound. It was a dwarf weapon, one of their thunder bows. He'd seen the mountain folk use them at Blackfire Pass and knew how lethal they could be. His mind made up, he swiftly followed the sounds to their source. Clad in hard-wearing leather and fur, Cuthwin was the colour of the forest, a ghost moving from shadow to shadow with carefully weighted footfalls. Dead leaves pressed softly into the dark earth without sound, and twigs were pushed aside by his buckskin boots. His long hunting knife was sheathed in a leather scabbard, and his pack was hung from a high tree branch 100 yards behind him. He kept his hair long, though it was pulled back over his ears and held by a leather cord around his temples. He scanned the forest to either side, his peripheral vision alert to anything moving on his flanks. He heard the clang of swords, the howls of wounded creatures, and more of the banging reports of thunderbows. The wind carried their smoke to his nostrils, acrid and reeking of hot metal, like Gavanon's forge on a hot day. Beneath that, there was a familiar smell of rank, unwashed bodies and rotten food. Cuthwin knew that smell. He remembered it from the days before Blackfire Pass, when he and Svine had scouted the mountains and discovered the vast host only days from descending into the Empire. Greenskins. He heard malicious, squealing voices, squawking war cries and vicious wolf barks, answered by deep, rumbling voices that sounded like they came from the deepest pits of the earth. Cuthwin eased through the forest, keeping his back to the trees and altering his approach every time the wind changed. Cuthwin was travelling alone, a dangerous pastime in the forests of the Empire, for all manner of peril lurked within their shadow-haunted depths. He knew the risks he took, but was confident enough in his skills to see such dangers as a challenge. To Cuthwin, there was nothing as liberating as spending time alone in the deep forests. To survive by his skill with a bow and an innate empathy with the seasonal lore of the wilds was what made him feel alive. The sounds of battle were growing louder, and Cuthwin pressed himself to the thick bole of a larch, easing his head around it and peering through its branches to the clearing below. The ground sloped down to the road, a rutted track almost obscured by high grass and gorse. Bodies lay strewn around four wagons arranged in a loose circle on the road. Six dwarfs, in long mail shirts, fought from the backs of the wagons, armed with a mix of hammers and short hafted axes. The mules hauling the wagons were dead, and a dozen wiry creatures with pallid green flesh wrapped in filth-encrusted rags surrounded them. Smaller and weaker than orcs, goblins were cunning little runts that had learned to strike from ambush and kill with a backstab and the low blow. A man or a dwarf was more than a match for a goblin in a straight contest of arms, but that wasn't how these vicious creatures fought. Half bore compact bows of horn and bone, while others swung curved blades with rusted and serrated edges. They rode emaciated wolves that howled with bloodlust, their fur matted and their jaws dripping with saliva. Two dwarfs emptied fine black powder into the barrels of their thunderbows, while the others slashed at any goblins that came too close. As things stood, the dwarfs would be overrun. But like Sigmar before him, Cuthwin would aid the beleaguered mountain folk. He hauled back on the string of his bow and sighted on a goblin with a skullcap of bright red leather. Orforth dismissed his class, knowing there would be no more work done today. He was disappointed, but remembered the excitement he had felt when the royal brothers, Bjorn and Birongenden, had ridden through his village behind their father, Redmane Dregor. The king had been magnificent that day, clad in his burnished bronze armour and leading a host of Unbarogan horsemen from the back of a tall, dapple stallion of grey and white. His white, bearskin cloak fell like a mantle of snow from his armoured shoulders, and his hair was the colour of fire. Powerful and elemental, Dregor had stopped beside him. "You are Orforth?" asked the king. "I am, my lord," he said, surprised the king knew his name. "And this is your village?" "I am the elder of Ingavon, yes." "I have heard of you, Orforth of Ingavon. The other village elders say you have no taste for war. Is that true?" "It's true, I have no love of killing, but I know it is sometimes necessary. That is why I have trained men under arms quartered here. It is also why I had our carpenters construct a high palisade wall and the village's stockade. I may not carry a sword in this world, but I know how to stay alive in it."
"Aye, they said you were a sly fox," said the king,
surveying the lines of the hilltop fort and the well-built and nigh impregnable walls of the settlement. "You may not swing a sword, but you wield that mind of yours like a weapon." The king sighed, looking him in the eye, and Orforth had been surprised at the marrow deep weariness he saw in his gaze. The king leaned down and lowered his voice so that only Orforth could hear his words.
"This world is changing,
but the hag mother of the Bracken Walsh tells me I will not live to change with it. That will be for those that come after me. I have need of men like you, men who know that not all battles are fought by warriors, that men of peace will one day be as important as men of war. I would hope that such a day is already here, Orforth had replied. Dregor laughed, a rich, wholesome sound that lifted the hearts of all who heard it. For a clever man, you are naive, Orforth, but I like your optimism. What is it you want of me, my lord? I want you to come to Reichdorf, said the king, in a tone that suggested this was not a request that could be ignored. My boys are good lads, but like their father, they are headstrong, all too eager to rush into battle without considering what other options may be open to them. When Borungandon is king, he will have need of a wise man at his side. I want you to be that wise man. I am flattered, my lord, said Orforth, genuinely taken aback. Then you'll do it? Of course. It would be an honour. Thus had begun his long years of service to the kings of the Unberogen, a life that had seen the Unberogen growing strength and prominence with every passing year. Beorn had readily accepted Orforth's counsel, but Borungandon was a warrior cast too closely in his father's image to listen to anyone's voice but his own. Proud, reckless, and full of Unberogen fire, Borungandon had died in the mountains to the north of the Fauslag Rock, torn to pieces by a winged beast that haunted the highest crags. A year later, King Dregor followed his son into the depths of Warrior Hill, his chest pierced by a dozen greenskin arrows, and Beorn had taken the crown. The power and influence of the Unberogen had steadily increased under Beorn's leadership, with many sword oaths and trade pacts sworn with neighbouring tribes. Golden goods from all across the land flowed into Reichdorf, and as the fame of Beorn's far-sightedness spread, many tribal kings came to his settlement to meet this wise ruler. Beorn honoured Orforth for his wisdom, and when Sigmar eventually took the crown after his father's death, fighting the Norsi, he had continued to advise the Unberogen king. Sigmar was now emperor, and Orforth knew his own span was coming to an end. Sigmar had proven to be a greater king than any of his ancestors, bringing all the tribes of men together under his rule, forging the empire of men and holding it firm in the face of all enemies. A mix of his father's keen mind and his grandfather's hot temper, Sigmar was a ruler fit for the empire. Warlike when roused to fight, diplomatic and persuasive when called to pass judgment. Of course, there had been times when Orforth's steadying hand had been required, such as the incident with Krugar and Aloysius and the dread crown of Morath. Thankfully, Sigmar had learned valuable lessons from those moments of weakness, a strength born from understanding that no man was infallible, that such perfection was best left to the gods. Since then, Orforth had quietly faded into the background, content to pass his teachings on to the next generation of Unberogen. He sighed, thinking back to his treatment of Teon. The lad had been rude and arrogant, but Orforth should have been above such retaliation. In striking the young boy, he had already lost. "I may not be a warrior, but I am Unberogen," he said, smiling as his good humour was restored at the recognition that no matter how cultured a man could become, there was no escaping his heritage. He gathered his books and writing tools from the desk, running a gnarled finger over the carvings around its lip. Master Holtwine was a master craftsman, and many of the pieces in the Emperor's longhouse had come from his workshop. His work was truly extraordinary, and was in demand by patrons as diverse as Count Otwin and Count Adelhard. Marius of the Jutones had several pieces, including a great bed frame carved with his heroic deeds during the battle for the Fauslag Rock. Orforth made his way from the classroom and stepped out into the warm spring sunlight. Winter had broken early, and the farmsteads around Reichdorf were being prepared for the sowing. The warm smell of freshly turned earth filled the air, even in the heart of the city, reminding Orforth that it was not by swords that empires endured, but by keeping food plentiful. He made his way along the street, meandering between the streams of youngsters as they gawped at the armoured horsemen. He saw Teon speaking to his father. Orforth wondered if he was recounting his punishment in class. He decided that was unlikely. He knew the boy and his father were not close. Orvin was of typical Unbarogan stock, broad-shouldered and powerfully built with a shock of dark hair. His bearing was confident to the point of arrogant, but unlike his son, he had earned the right to walk with a swagger. Offorth waved as he saw Alfgeir walking his horse along the cobble street towards him. "Welcome home, Grand Knight of the Empire," said Offorth. "I take it you were successful. The orcs are defeated?" Alfgeir lifted his helmet's visor and scowled at Offorth's use of his formal title. Alfgeir had many titles, Grand Knight of the Empire being but his most recently acquired. Marshal of the Reich was another, but to Offorth he would always simply be his friend.
"That we were, High Scholar of the Empire," replied Alfgeir, returning the favour. "We caught them at Astafen and trapped them against the river."
"Astafen?" said Offorth, as Alfgeir walked his horse towards a water trough. "Strange how the greenskins always find their way back to Astafen. I wonder what draws them there."
"Does it matter? They come and we kill them."
"And the following year they will need killing again." Alfgeir nodded and looked over towards the flag flying over the longhouse to the north of the city.
"Any news of the Emperor?" he asked.
It had been nearly 9 months since Sigmar had set off to the north. With ships requisitioned from Count Maris's fleet at Jutonsrik, he'd taken the swords of the Empire across the frozen seas to the lands many were already calling Norska. The North Sea were going to learn that there were consequences to attacking Sigmar's realm. "There is indeed," said Offorth. "Redwane sends word from the Fauslag that Sigmar's ships have put ashore in Udo's lands at a place called Horgrevik."
"Do you think they found him?"
"Garion? I doubt it," said Offorth. "We would have heard."
Alfgeir nodded, having already suspected that would be the answer. "So, when is Sigmar coming back to Reichdorf?"
"As soon, I expect. If they're done with the war across the sea, then they're probably on their way now."
"Good," said Alfgeir. "It's time he was back. We're not an empire without an emperor."
Alfgeir had a point. In the year following the great victory against the North Sea, the empire had weathered the storm of war in consolidation. Each of the counts had returned to their lands to regroup and refortify. But instead of returning to Reichdorf, Sigmar had gathered a force of warriors and crossed the sea to make war on the North Sea. No more would the banished tribes of the North dwell with impunity in their frozen homelands, believing themselves safe from attack. Yet, without the Emperor, the people of the Unbarogan grew restive, withdrawing behind their palisade walls and spears. Many traders now carried on up the coast to Marburg and Jutunsrik, or headed east to Three Hills, or south to Sigurdheim. The Unbarogan needed their Emperor back. The horse lowered its head, and Alfgeir patted its flanks as squires arrived from the stables to care for the knight's mounts. These were beasts bred from Wolfgard stock, wide-chested, powerful and trained to fight, bred for strength and musculature, not speed and height. The knight's horses were squat and pugnacious beasts. Iron plates riveted to a boiled leather harness protected the horse's flank, while segmented bands of iron and mail sheathed its neck and head. "Maybe the greenskins keep attacking Astafen due to its historical significance," suggested Offorth, returning to their earlier discussion.
"I still don't see why it matters," said Alfgeir.
"Perhaps if we knew why they came, we could do something about it," said Offorth, as Alfgeir's squire led the horse away to be stripped of its armour, rubbed down, fed, and watered. The care of a good warhorse was a thorough and expensive business. Alfgeir sat on a stone bench at the side of the street, and Offorth saw how tired he was. It was a long ride from Astafen, and as much as the Empire was far safer than it had been in Bjorn's time, it still did not do to be away from the scattered pockets of civilization for too long. Orcs were not the only dangers that lurked in the depths of the Empire's forests.
"Very well, I will indulge you, scholar. But what is there to do?" said Alfgeir, tilting his head back to allow the breeze to cool his skin. "Orcs are savages. They are driven by their lust for blood. There is no force in this world that can change that."
"You may be right," said Offorth, sitting next to him. "It is a depressing thought."
"That I am right, or that the orcs will never change?"
Offorth smiled. "I was referring to the orcs, my friend. Tell me, does the dwarf bridge still stand to the south of Astorfen?
It does, said Alfgeir. And someone has erected a shrine on the north bank.
Oh, dedicated to which god?
To no god. It is dedicated to Sigmar.
To Sigmar, chuckled Orforth. An understandable gesture, but let us hope it is too small for the gods to notice and take offence.
Indeed, said Alfgeir, removing his helmet and pulling back the coif.
He set the helmet next to him and ran a hand through his sweat-streaked hair. Orforth noticed it was thinning at the crown, and there was more than a hint of grey to its hue.
Alfgeir saw the look and said, None of us are getting any younger, scholar.
He smiled as he said it, but Orforth saw the horror of ageing in the warrior's eyes. He forced a smile. There's truth in that, my friend. Even I am starting to feel old. They sat in companionable silence for a while, watching the youngsters fussing around the knights, offering to carry their lances, lead their horses, or polish their armour. The knights shooed them away with smiles or pantomime growls, and Orforth watched the boys following behind them, wielding sticks like swords and miming the slaying of their enemies.
"How goes the teaching?" asked Alfgeir, nodding towards the books in Orforth's lap.
"Slowly," admitted Orforth. "As you see, the boys are more interested in learning to kill than to read poetry or count."
"We will always need warriors to defend us," pointed out Alfgeir,
"and we will also need poets to inspire them, artists to commemorate them, and tallymen to organise their armies."
"Young men don't care for that," said Alfgeir. "They hunger for glory, not numbers and letters. And Barogan boys weren't made for study. I mean no offence by that. The pursuit of wisdom is an honourable one."
"And no offence taken," said Orforth. "But it saddens me that we still need warriors at all. Wasn't the foundation of the Empire supposed to be an end to wars?"
"Even a rose needs thorns to defend it," said Alfgeir.
Orforth gave Alfgeir a sidelong look. "Poetry?" Alfgeir looked embarrassed.
"I read that book you loaned me, the writings of the Burgundian saga poet. What was his name?"
"Sigynert," said Orforth. "I wasn't sure you'd read it."
"I read it," replied Alfgeir. "It just took me a while."
"What did you think of it?"
Alfgeir shrugged. "A lot of it went over my head, but I liked his words."
Orforth laughed and pushed himself to his feet.
"That's about all a poet can hope for, I suppose."